Toronto! I wonder if they can hear it on Long Island.
Great move. What a goal. Beauty. Austin Matthews.
Bless you, boys. What a game.
Welcome to episode 62 of the Maple Leaf Hot Stove podcast. I'm Nick Ashbourne, joined as always by Anthony Petrielli. And normally when we talk to you, more has happened from an on-ice perspective. There's been two games, but it does feel like a lot has happened for the Maple Leafs from an off-ice perspective. It's been a bit of an eventful time since the trade deadline. And Anthony, where I want to start with that is with Mitch Marner. And as we record this podcast, he has a high ankle sprain that is being described as more than day-to-day, which is pretty ambiguous, something that's looking to get ramped up for next week. Neither of us are doctors. I don't think we're qualified to prognosticate on exactly how long he's going to be out, but what we are qualified to do is to talk about how it's going to affect, how his absence will affect the Maple Leafs and which players are going to step up. And we've always seen a little bit of that, but what are you kind of looking for in the category of guys filling in around Marner?
Well, I think the big thing is looking to see how viable a non-Matthews Marner and also at the same time non-Matthews Nylander combination sort of flips out. So we saw, we've only really seen the two games. So the first one being against the Habs, the Matthews Nylander Bertuzzi line was awful. That, it's just the truth. They weren't good. And for the second piece of that, we saw what we were hoping to see is Yarncroak with Matthews and Bertuzzi, and they did get off to a pretty good start. I know their first goal technically involved Nylander, so I don't want to give them like the full, depth of credit. Bertuzzi scored a goal that was called back, they did produce. So all in all to say is we've kind of been beating this drum all the time of like, you could spread these guys out. Like Matthews does not need to play with Mitch Marner to be good at hockey. He's a really good hockey player and can do it on his own. He scored the goal that essentially iced the game on a line with Bertuzzi and Holmberg. Like he doesn't need a ton. So if you're able to start realizing that through some of these combinations, and then in turn you get Marner back, now you could potentially look at legitimately doing the thing we've always wanted to see, which is spread these guys out across three lines. And the three guys is Matthews, Marner, and Nylander, not Matthews, Marner together, Nylander, and aging John Tavares carrying a line.
Yeah, and the Matthews-Bertuzzi component is the most interesting one to me because, the Maple Leafs signed Bertuzzi with the idea that he would probably play on the first line with Matthews and with Marner. From just a stylistic component, it works so well. Like Bertuzzi's a guy who is a pass first guy who looks for his teammates, but at the same time, he's someone who goes to the net. So when Matthews is firing off all of these mid-range shots, you're going to see rebounds, you're going to see tipping opportunities. So he kind of combines two worlds where he is a little bit of that puck retriever forechecking guy who just feeds Matthews the puck, but he's also someone who can make things happen at the net. And it just made too much sense for these guys to be together. And yet circumstances have sort of pried them apart over the course of the year. But I think we always knew at some point this was going to have to be tried. And, Thursday's game was the best example of what those two guys together can look like and how much offense they can get out of them. And that line changed a lot to the game, right? Like you mentioned that Nylander was on the ice for the first goal. Then you had the Yarncroak injury, which we're going to get to. And then, Pontus Holmberg, your boy, comes on at the end, and that helps drive some offense as well. And it kind of goes to the theory, which, again, we've seen since Matthews' rookie year, that he doesn't necessarily need superstars alongside him to produce. And I know that you can say, oh, he always had Zach Hyman, but we know that the name Zach Hyman can be associated with various levels of production. He was not a superstar when he first played with Matthews. And that is, as you said, I think that's the biggest part of it, is seeing this Matthews with secondary guys concept, because that is a really compelling concept. The other part of it with Marner is, you always look at Marner, he's got these ridiculous time on ice numbers. He's out all the time, right? And so you are giving those minutes have to go somewhere, and particularly on special teams. Like you saw William Nylander come out for the first PK, whereas he's been someone who often comes out more in the middle of shifts in transitionary points of penalty kill. And you could argue whether that went well or it didn't go well. I would say the goal on Thursday was kind of one of those bounce goals that isn't necessarily really anyone's fault. But the reality is you get a more of a look of that, and you get, you know, the power play, you get to mix things up as well. And I don't think that worked in a really productive way. I think sometimes Marner's presence on the power play is underappreciated, to be honest, because I think the Leafs power play at its worst is Matthews and Nylander kind of trading mid-range attempts, and Marner facilitates some more creative chances than that. And I don't think you'll see anyone fill that gap. Max Domi's probably the guy most able to theoretically do the things Marner does, but they haven't really given that a look. And I think realistically Marner is on PP1. It's like locked in. So it's not, I don't think you're going to learn very much from his absence on that side of it.
Yeah. I think the specialty teams is problematic in general, because to your point, he's going to walk back in and go on to the top power play unit, which he should. He's really good, and the power play has looked out of sorts, but I also think that's what happens when you lock in the power play to one unit and you overload them all year. And now, like, it's almost a good thing that this kind of thing is happening now, so that they have some time to adjust. But they've thrown out units that legitimately have looked like strangers. Like, you would swear these guys were never teammates before. Just by virtue of what, putting like Kelly Yarncroc on the top power play unit, or putting Tavares and Bertuzzi on instead, you know, in absence of Marner, but those guys playing together, and ergo, like, one isn't just like a de facto net guy. And because of those like subtle tweaks, like, these guys suddenly don't know how to play on a power play together, which is what it's looked like by and large. So that is not a good thing. And to your point, Marner will just walk back in and be on the top power play unit. And again, he should. He's really good. They've actually struggled more on the entries than I anticipated. I've really liked the idea of Nylander being the carrier, or, you know, one of the slingshot guys, if you want to call it that. And so far, like, early returns, I've found myself more wanting to have Marner on the ice for that than I've enjoyed watching, or, you know, it's not whether I've enjoyed it or not, just literally just witnessing Nylander try to do it. It hasn't been as sharp, I would say. So, you know, what Nylander has in speed, probably some of it's lost in timing, I would say. You know, it's almost like it works a little bit to Marner's benefit, the pace, which isn't slow. I don't want to say it's slow, but it's a slower pace, which makes it a little bit easier for him to kind of saunter through that center ice to blue line area and kind of poke holes in coverage and like find little passes and dish offs to the wall to like cleanly gain the zone. Whereas like Nylander goes so fast sometimes that no one can keep up with it. And, you know, it's like he's like chipping it to the wall and it's always like a foot ahead of the guy, and it's basically like a dump in. So
yeah, you've got to believe that he can do it. You know what I mean?
Of course, like, on a skill wise, of course.
Yeah, it's a lack of practice, familiarity, etc.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you're like, if Marner's out for a long time, like, they'll never be able to figure this component out.
Of course
out.
They can. Like, yeah.
Nylander, it's just to say, I've so liked good it better. At it, even, oh, for sure. Again, because it's just so polished. It's so refined. It's like, it's easy to kind of fail to appreciate how good this unit is when you get tired of it. Like, you can just nitpick it because it's like, oh, yeah, they're doing this. This is getting stale. Why is it this? It's like, it's actually pretty hard to have, you know, the top 2-3 power play in the entire NHL, like, multiple years in a row. Like, that, I know that they had, like, they loaded up the talent and the money on the forward, so it makes sense. But at the same time, it's easy to just get used to that being a given. And then you take Marner out and you're like, you know what? Maybe it isn't a given that you just get to have a power play that's at the very top of the league.
Yeah, I think a lot of the complaints on the power play come from people just seeing the same thing all the time, to the point where it's hard for them to distinguish like what's reality and like what's the general baseline. You know, like, they're working off of the baseline of how like incredibly talented all of these guys are versus like the baseline of the general NHL, which is to say, you know, the power play has looked jumbled lately. Like, at, you know, at one point Riley threw a pass that like hit Mark Matthews in the back and yeah, Philly shot it out. And I was watching it going like, this is actually what, and I don't say that as like, I've only watched the Leafs, to say this is like, when I watch most teams on the power play, like, this is the kind of thing that you see. like not necessarily, you know, guy hit it in the back with the puck, but just sort of this like jumbled, uncoordinated. It's hard for them to set up. When they do, it's not like the sharpest sort of thing. Like that's what a lot of NHL power plays look like. I think we're probably spoiled, not just seeing the Leafs, but at the same time, we see Tampa a lot. We see Boston a lot. We see Florida a lot. Like high-end elite teams, like these teams are very like very much not like the regular NHL. Like these are generally speaking like four top 10 teams.
Yeah, and I mean it is a bit odd to say because the Flyers did get that power play goal, but that's the worst power play in the NHL. And when you watch them, like a lot of the time, they did not look particularly threatening
Purposeless.
against a Leafs penalty kill that is not objectively not good and is onboarding a bunch of new players. So it's like the Leafs power penalty kill is sort of at a low baseline, and it's also at a low ebb. And against that group, again, it is weird to be like, oh, well, they did score, so the results were good enough. But like that was kind of an example of what you're saying, where if you're someone who just is consistently watching the Leafs and kind of zeroing in on the Leafs, it is easy to forget that other teams don't necessarily have players of this caliber. Other teams don't have units that hum like this, that have that level of familiarity, that have that danger, you know, that threat level. And so, you know, Marner being out of the mix, I don't think it means that they're doomed to fail in that regard. Like they can still succeed without Marner, but if the group just isn't quite the same without him for a little bit, you know, however long this is going to take, because the Leafs are in a pretty safe spot in the standings anyway, it's not really a big worry. I mean, I guess if Marner goes down in the playoffs, then you got to think about this all over again. But having a few weeks or a few games or whatever it is where you're trying different guys and your power play, instead of being the second most efficient in the NHL, is the 13th, like, sure, whatever. I like, that's not a big picture problem.
No, I think the biggest problem is the penalty kill, because the penalty kill is legitimately bad. He does need to be a part of it. Like he is a good penalty killer. It's look, like we said it at the deadline. Like that's clearly something they targeted. Like I don't think they just brought Joel Edmondson in to be a partner for Timothy Liljegren. Like I do think penalty kill played a role in that acquisition. They obviously brought in Connor Dewar as part of the penalty kill, but like those guys, I think in part were brought in to help support some of their top guys a little bit more, Marner being one of them, Kampf being another one of them. And now you've lost like a linchpin of that. And now you've also just lost Kyle Yarncroc for a few weeks, it looks like, with a hand injury. And now you're scraping together the penalty kill again with like popsicle sticks and glue. And how are you going to improve? Like the penalty kill is the kind of thing that could cost them a series. Like that, like to me, that's one of the worst case scenarios of the playoffs, basically being like the guys show up and the top guys are full marks, and you just can't get past a penalty kill being terrible, and you lose in large part because of that. Like I would find that fairly criminal to this group. You know, if the top guys don't show up, I think that's a pretty simple and straightforward conversation. Once again, you know, if any number of scenarios, you run into a hot goalie, like things happen to certain extents, all that. I personally couldn't sit there and stomach just the penalty kill's terrible and it was bad all year and they never fixed it and they tried bringing in a few extra guys and guys got hurt and it was this jumbled mess. And it just, ergo, you know, ended up costing them. Like you can't, it's really hard to score 5-on-5 in the playoffs. Special teams are huge. Come playoff time, you can't be having to outscore your penalty kill. You know, if you give up like let's say 6 or 7 goals on the penalty kill in a series, like you can't be having to like make up like 6 or 7 goals plus like whatever else is happening on the ice during like regular play. Like that's a huge ask. So, you know, I'm happy to see the line experimenting at 5-on-5. To your point, I'm sure they'll figure out the power play or make it at least respectable enough. I'm not worried about Marner coming back and you know, the power play picking up where it left off kind of thing. But the penalty kill's concern is a real problem. Like I don't know what the fix is. They need to sort it out. I just like you know, you mentioned the penalty kill goal against Philly. And I saw, you know, they were saying it too in the broadcast, kind of like, well, like it was a bit of a bounce, like it was outside of structure. Like, yeah, I agree. But like also, why did a guy on the Flyers get a shot from the top of the circle unguarded? Like he missed the net, but why did he get that shot? Like what? Like he had no pressure. I've watched the goal like four times. Like why was he this open in this area of the ice with like hardly a guy within stick length of him to like bother him? Like that was the problem. It's like that is the problem, not the rebound tip it, you know, tip it banking it home after. It's why did he get the shot in the first place? His power play is terrible. It's like historically one of the worst of all time.
I think the thing with the penalty kill, which, and I'm not going to ride to the defense of its performance over the course this year because the numbers are what they are. And it's not even like the goaltending has been particularly bad as in a factor to drag it down. That hasn't really been the issue. What I would say is that, you know, they have made these moves. And if you have, you know, you have about five forwards who kill penalty kills, unit one, unit two, and then someone is in the box, so you need to have someone else. So maybe call it six, but maybe five that you really need. And on defense, again, you got two pairs, someone in the box, five. So that's 10 players that you need to be ready to be like quality penalty killers. And you've added three, you know, like you've added Lyubushkin, you've added Edmundson, you've added Dewar. So I don't think we 100% know how what the baseline of this new unit is yet, and I'm not going to be like I predict that it's suddenly going to be incredible because, but when you shift out 30% of the players who are involved, like it is fair to expect that the results could shift. And I don't, again, it's not for me to predict that it's all going to click into place perfectly and that Leafs fans should take great heart, but they did make an effort to address this part of the team. They recognize the weakness. That was kind of the theme of the deadline. And at this point, you can look at the stats for the whole season, but I'm kind of going to be more interested in what this penalty kill does over the whatever the 21 games after the trade deadline or whatever that exact number is, because it is fundamentally a different group at this point. Not necessarily going to be an incredible group, and we can take our guesses at how much these guys are going to be difference makers or not, but they're, you know, a lot of them bring good qualities and good reputations in this area, and so I don't think the Leafs are necessarily doomed to have this penalty kill. It's going to be immensely costly.
Yeah, we're 2 games in, so I'm 100% willing to give it time. I'm just saying it's difficult when, like, two guys you bank on are now out again, and it's like, yeah, you know, to some degree, it's trial by fire for Dewar, which is probably going to be a good thing, by and large, when it's all said and done. But like, I would like to see that unit get rolling with the top guys and like everything, you know, in place. But if Dewar can emerge in this time of need, then kudos to him. That would be a significant development for the team. It's just that is something that's very much on my mind. The last thing I'll say for Marner before we switch topics, because I do think this is an important thing to flag, is you saw it against Philly. I thought is the Leafs looked really tired last week. Like we talked about it on that second half of the Boston game, in Boston being a schedule loss, right? Like, they were sick. It was a back-to-back. They traveled. The Bruins were rested, healthy, and at home. You know, turned out like the Leafs had some travel issues that night too. Like they didn't even arrive to Boston until like 3 in the morning. You know, like they looked tired. They genuinely looked tired. I know people don't like always hearing that, and it sounds like an excuse, but like you also have to be honest about the realities of an 82-game season. Like that's just a thing that happens. Teams get tired and they look worn down, and they did look worn down. Including in Montreal, like Matthews and Nylander, and like they were not good. That is very much not the norm, like how bad they were that night. And all that says when they played Philly, like they looked rejuvenated. That looked like a
A hundred
team that,
percent, a hundred
right?
percent.
And so you mentioned like all the minutes Marner plays. Like I do think there's something there to like rest up. Like you're gonna have to be an animal in the playoffs. Like they're not winning in spite of Marner. Like Marner will have to be a critical player. Like I think everyone knows this, and I think that's also what frustrates everyone, given how he's generally performed come playoff time. But like I do see a benefit, like a beneficial path here, whereby he's rested and he comes in to the playoffs healthy, ready to go, not gassed, like has extra legs and juice to him. I think there could be something there. I mean, it's up to him to capitalize on that, but I do think that is like that, and what's happening at five on fives are huge positives, I think. What's happening on the special teams are huge negative. All in all, I would take that though, because I think the five on five play and what's happening with the line combinations, and also just a healthy rested Marner, knock on wood, it's a high ankle sprain. I know that's a tricky injury, But provided he gets fully healthy and rested and all that fun stuff, like I think those are two very quiet wins for the team.
Yeah, I think the team should be as cautious as humanly possible with them. One, because of where they are in the standings, there's not really a lot of mobility for them. They could catch Boston if they use all their games in hand and Boston falls off a cliff. But like, if we're being realistic about it,
They
that's just
cooked
not a sin.
themselves. The
It's
two
just,
games last week, they
yeah,
cooked themselves.
it's not going to happen. So you want Marner, like you said, rested as much energy as possible, and also the lowest possible risk of re-aggravating that injury. So give him as much time as he possibly needs. Now, I'm sure listeners know that I'm dying to talk about the Bobby McMahon contract. Before we get there, any last thoughts on the Yarncroke injury, him being out week to week beyond the penalty killing component? For me, it's less of a hot topic because we just saw it. There's a lot of talk about how essentially was the team and then he was out. And again, it's not me ragging on him, but like they were able to manage that at 5-on-5.
I'll just say two things on it. One, again, just bummed that we didn't get to see more of that Yarncroke, Matthews, Bertuzzi line, because if that line works in theory, and then you start looking at who you have to play with on your other two lines in your top nine, like it gets pretty, like you feel really good about it, like really quickly. Like if you're like, oh my God, I have like a line with Matthews on it and it's good, and I still haven't figured out where Marner and Nylander and Tavares and Knies and McMahon and like all these guys are playing, like wow, that's an unbelievable problem to have in your life. So, you know, that part is a bummer, but I will say on the flip side, it's opportunity for Nick Robertson. It's probably been the thing I've enjoyed most about the team this year is all of these guys coming into the lineup and this battle for roster spots that we're watching. I've been a broken record on this topic for years where like these lines get set in and you know it's generally been a good thing that the top guys have stayed healthy. Like obviously that's a good thing over the run, but like to some ways it's almost worked in their detriment because things have been so locked in and they've been so good in the regular season that come playoff time when like there's any sort of like adversity and they don't have any other line combos to go with. I mean, it was pretty seamless last night watching Pontus Holmberg just move up to the top line. It was like business as usual. I wasn't sitting there going like, oh my God, I have to watch Pontus Holmberg play with Matthews for the first time. Or it like there wasn't some sort of weird reaction. Whereas I 100% would have felt like that if it was, you know, Pierre Engvall, if it was like Wayne Simmonds suddenly getting promoted to the top line, which happened in the playoffs, like things of that nature where you're kind of going, one, it's either like hasn't happened, or two, it's a weird fit, or three, like, how are we here? I more of just look at it as, oh, okay, nice. Like there's all these sort of chess pieces that they can move around, Nick Robertson being one of them. And this is just another opportunity for him to continue developing his game. Like I understand why he is out of the lineup when they are healthy. I agree with it 100%. Like I fully get what Keefe is doing and I get how the roster is configured at the moment. And it's unfortunate for him that it's a numbers game. But I'm not down on him as a player. Like you know, I'm still fairly optimistic about him. He's very young. He finally looks this year like he's growing into his body a little bit, like he's putting some weight on. Growing into his body is probably not the right frame, like term when he's like small. Like he's been growing into that body for a while. He's adding mass into that body and he's no longer putting himself in situations to get hurt like routinely the way he was and the way he was getting hurt. And he's producing. So you know, I think it's been a good year for him. He's an RFA. Like they should be able to retain him for cheap. And you kind of see, which I think leads us into the Bobby McMahon contract extension, which is to say, you can already see the outline of their forward group for next year. It's right in front of your face. They have 10 forwards signed already.
Yeah, they've got this group of quasi compelling middle six wingers. And then, like, there are holes you can poke in this lineup. And when Bertuzzi goes, what are you going to do on the first line? And it's not like it's job done, like, wash your hands of it by any means. But there is an outline of a forward group in a way that there hasn't always been when it's kind of like year to year, we're getting another fourth line and we're replacing it with defensively oriented vets who don't have much mobility up and down the lineup. And as you said, this is a good transition to Bobby McMahon because he got the bag, the 2-year, $2.7 million contract. this is, I don't know, it's just a really classic win-win, right? Like, this is a guy who fought all his way to get here. You know, he's been up against the odds for a long time. And so you can understand from his perspective, just getting some level of security and getting a multi-year contract has got to be such a big deal. You can be confident that he's happy about this, and his teammates are happy about this. You know, this is a guy that they pull for as well. It's just very hard for me to envision a world where the Leafs aren't happy with this contract too. I mean, you're not, you know, 2 years, an amount of money that even if it went somehow horribly wrong and he totally forgot how to play hockey or got injured, it's not a huge deal. But I don't know, like the Bobby McMahon we've seen over the last few weeks, last couple months, looks like a guy who can play on a third line in the NHL. He's big, he's fast, he can shoot the puck. Like you know, he's not always making the most advanced decisions. He's not some incredible playmaker. He's relatively reliable all over the ice. Like, this is a type of player where he wasn't going to get paid big dollars if he made it to free agency, just because he has a weird, relatively short track record and he's not actually that young. But at the same time, guys who do similar things to Bobby McMahon, have similar amount of value on the ice, are going to get paid a lot more. And McMahon, you get him at this kind of discount because there's some level of question about what he can do because his track record is limited. But he has these traits like the size, the speed, the shot. These things aren't going anywhere, you know, in his mid late 20s. So I see no loss for the Maple Leafs, and maybe McMahon could have taken it to free agency and found a team that was in love with the traits he brings to the table, but it's understandable for him to just say, here's an opportunity to get a multi-year contract, just something in that would have been inconceivable in the NHL for him not long ago.
Yeah, so I think there's a few things. I think it's a win all around. Like, it's a nice reward for Bobby McMahon, obviously. Like, he's earned it, and it's a great story coming up from the minors. And then I think it's a great piece of business for the Leafs, just in terms of it's low risk, as you said, but it also protects them. That was my biggest fear. Like, I wrote on Monday that I would look to do this type of 2-year deal. I said up to a maximum of 1.5, and my logic in climbing as high up to that number was essentially the variable amount in the AHL is 1.15. And I assumed if you were going to have to sign him, it would have to be at least that, if not more. Because at that point, why would he take anything beyond, like, you know, anything below the variable amount? At that point, you might as well test your luck at free agency. So I thought, okay, it's probably that's like the baseline, like absolute low. What would be the high point that you would probably go up to? Let's call it 1.5. Because I don't think he's obviously established that he's a $2 million type of player yet, just based on his track record and lack of games played in the league. But I think he's shown enough to suggest that he's just, if nothing else, to your point, a regular NHLer. Like, he is an NHLer. Like, he's. And he has some traits that you like as part of that package. He's not a liability. He's big. He's strong. He's fast. You can trust him in some situations. He doesn't look out of place on the second power play unit by any means. He definitely hasn't looked out of place closing games defensively for the team, and in fact has done a good job multiple times so far in that role. Plus, you add in a little sprinkle of offense. And I went, okay, he's probably going to fall somewhere between that 1.15 and 1.5. And it ended up pretty much being right in the middle of that at the 1.35, which I think is a great deal. Now you get to free agency and you look at the market. Now, McMahon is obviously not particularly accomplished compared to so many other guys. Like, even a player like Jason Zucker, we'll call it, who does have a longer track record in the league and, you know, can point to some level of production. But what McMahon does have that would intrigue teams is age, right? Like, he's still 27, he's turning 28. There are very few free agents in that age bracket. That's just the reality of free agency. Most guys that are in the market are by and large in their 30s, right? Like, we're seeing, you know, Max Domi, the Leafs just signed him. He was 28, just turned 29. Like, Tyler Bertuzzi, he's in that age range. But then you look at quite a few of the other guys and they are, you know, either about to hit 30 or are just past it. So if you're a team and you're looking to free agency and you see a player who's 28, potentially a little bit untapped potential, if he has a couple of good playoff games in this market, I think we've seen that shine up on players. Like I mentioned it this week on the Kipper and Bourne show. Like Ilya Lyubushkin made way more money than he probably should have in free agency. And I think a large part of that was his showing with the Leafs in this market. And I don't think anyone was looking at Luke Shen going, he's getting 3 by 2.75 when he was on Vancouver. And he comes here and he has a good playoffs. And he actually got a bag like that. Great story. Like super happy for him. I wish he was still here. But like I do think that there's a glow up in the Toronto market in terms of pricing. I think we've seen it across the board. So that was my biggest fear of him going off. And by going off, I mean probably like a couple of good games, like
Like,
really like
yeah, two
notable
goals in a
games.
six game series is enough to go off in this context.
2 goals, maybe a fight, like a couple of good hits, and he's probably making more money. He'd probably get more money than what he just got on the free agency market. Now, there's a chance that he does like next to nothing, and you go, okay, well, he may not even have got 1.35. And to me, like, I'm fine with that situation because I think he'll be worth the money regardless. I think he has a little bit of room to continue to improve. I think we're starting to see him figure out the league. And if you look at the trajectory of his career, last thing I'll say on McMahon is he's generally been a late bloomer. Like I'm not expecting him to like take off to Jonathan Marchessault levels or anything, but I think he can get a little bit better here and be a semi-regular producer. Like he's almost pacing for like a 40-point season in his half season.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit of a floor too. Like because again, because he has the size and the speed and he likes to throw his body around. Like if the offense really dried up, like I think you'd be a functional fourth liner and you'd be like, "Oh, I wish I'd given that fourth line spot maybe to a minimum salary guy," but the difference between that is small enough that it's just really hard to see the risk here. And if he does develop a little bit, has that late bloomer in him, then maybe he is that winger with a little bit of line mobility who is a regular on your third line, but maybe you mix it up and you throw him alongside Tavares on the second line for a 10-game run, or you can put him on that first line on the left, see what happens for a few games if another player is underperforming or if there's an injury. Like he does have that in him. I think, as I said, I've always been a big supporter, so maybe I'm a little bit biased there, but it's just hard to see the
Ever since he
downside.
had that hat trick against St. Louis, eh? Like you've been totally in.
Yeah, well, you know what? I was there before. A lot of people needed two of those games. I only needed one
He
to jump all
he
in.
looked good in the 10 games last year. Just the, bounces didn't go his way. He had the disallowed goal on the kicking motion against Detroit. He had one assist in 10 games, but I remember watching him back then going like he can play in this league. If nothing else, he can play in this league. So and, I kind of felt similar about Pontus Holmberg, who I was looking at it today, actually. So he hit 37 games last night, and he had 37 games last year, and he has the exact same point total as he did all of last year. It was like 13 and 37 last year. It's 13 and 37 right now. But funny enough is that in theory, you would look at it and go, well, last year he was actually playing center. And so for him to like have that production and come in and like be an effective player is probably more impressive than doing it on the wing, all things considered this year. But I've really liked him this year. Like he's really come along, and to your point, like this like middle six group of guys is sort of starting to come together, and that's why I've continued to be on this train of like it's not do or die for me this year. Like last year it was because they swung for the fences. Like that was very obvious. Like they made huge moves for Ryan O'Reilly and Jake McCabe. Like they paid up a ton of draft capital, and McCabe's been good this year, but like you go look at the price, like they didn't get him for cheap. Like it's nice that they added him, and the cap hit is significant to the overall team and some of the other things they've been able to do, but like that was not a free player. Like that was a huge price that they paid for him and like essentially a fourth liner and Sam Lafferty. So last year had that vibe, whereas this year it kind of feels a little bit more I don't know, like fresh and exciting in some ways. Like I'm not, I want to see progress. Like I want to see them go toe to toe with these teams. Like I thought Florida handled them pretty, they handled their business. Like that was in five. And I like this year, like I need to see more fight within the series. And and not like the level of lapses we've seen, but I find myself optimistic as we talk about these McMahon and Holmberg types who are already signed for next year, and we're seeing like Knives come along as the season goes along, and we've definitely been hard on him at times, which has been rightfully earned on his end. And at the same time, I think we can acknowledge that his game has improved, and I see like a second level of guys finally developing instead of looking at like the ghost of Jason Spezza, the ghost of Joe Thornton, the ghost of Wayne Simmonds. Like, go down, take your pick. I much rather this route.
Yeah, and I think it's refreshing to not rely on having a huge slice of your roster being old dudes who used to be good, who are up from the general area geographically. As a building strategy, I don't think a lot of teams do that, and don't think the Maple Leafs should necessarily do that either. That group that we're referring to is primarily on the wing, and I think if you look up the middle, there's a lot more uncertainty about what this team
Yes.
is and what this team is going to be beyond the obvious building block in Auston Matthews. And we've seen a bit of a shift in recent games as Max Domi has gone back on the wing, and you've got the David Kampf on the third line, and you've got the new guy, Connor Dewar, on the fourth line. And I have myself find myself having a little bit of trouble with the rationale, but I get the rationale. The rationale being that, like, Sheldon Keefe likes having all his lines be lines he's comfortable with in most situations from a defensive standpoint, and that is driving this logic. But man, like, I feel like, and I know that you're sort of with me because I think you talked about this a little bit with Kipper and Bourne, but the David Kampf third line center experience, I feel like we had that
Yeah.
experience already, and like his numbers alongside Knies, for example, were just brutal. And there's this notion that, oh, we can put Kampf with two really offensive oriented players and he can be their conscience. And that idea makes sense to some degree, but I think it disregards the other side of it, where I think he's bad enough offensively that he legitimately drags his line mates down. Like, I think of a moment on Thursday where Bobby McMahon got a puck to an extremely dangerous area right in front of the net, and the guy whose stick it gets to is David Kampf's because he's the center and he's the one driving to the net there, and it just kind of tips right into the goalie and nothing happens. And it's just like, that seems like the type of experience that you're going to have a lot for a third line that, it's as good as the Maple Leafs core four top guys are, whatever you want. Like, I just don't like the idea of really punting offense on the third line. And as good as some of these, middle six wingers are, the way they're developing, I just don't know if they can drag David Kampf to a confident offensive performance.
Yeah, and to that, I'll circle back to our first point. Like, that's why I'm most bummed about the Yarncroc situation, because to me, Bertuzzi, Matthews, and Yarncroc on paper anyway is a viable line. Like, legit. Like,
For sure, yeah.
I don't think you're sewering Matthews in any capacity. I think they're both good enough defensively alongside Matthews, who's good defensively, to at minimum go up against a Barkov line who's been running absolute train on the league all year. And it to like hold Bort. And then you're looking at a battle of a Nylander Tavares or a Nylander Domi with like McMahon or Knies on the other side line. I would probably do it like almost how they have it now, or it'd be like McMahon, Tavares, Nylander. I know they have Domi there, but I'm saying flip them. You have that line against either the Anton Lundell line or the Sam Bennett line. And then on the flip side, you have a Domi, Marner, Knies line against, again, one of those two. And I feel like you'd actually feel pretty good about that, all things considered. Like, if Marner or Nylander is going up against that Anton Lundell, Lestarainen, and third line, I think you would like that matchup. And that's why I like that line of the top guys all spread out across the board, and Matthews kind of holding fort. And I think it's really important that they see this coming up, right? Like, they have Carolina. That's a really tough game. Carolina looks like they look good. Like, they're a good team, and they made big moves at the deadline. They just handled their business against Florida. You know, Florida's lost to two teams in the last 22 games, and they lost to both teams twice. So Carolina's won. Do you know who the other one is?
No, I suspect it's going to be something very random, though.
Philly.
Philly, wow.
Philly.
Okay.
So, but I look at it and say, like, you need like three legit lines. I don't know if David Camp can do that, to your point. He would need to push the needle offensively a little bit. Like, it can't just be enough of like you come deep in the zone and you back check hard and you're an F3. Like, I don't think that suffices on my end of what they are required, like what's going to be required to beat Florida. So, I want to see kind of a bit more of that spread out attack. I think the biggest issue is when you look at it, like that Domi Nylander Bertuzzi line was just an absolute liability. Like, they were a mess defensively. They outscored all their problems, but like we all saw what happened. It's like anytime the puck went into their zone, it was like a complete nightmare. It's like they never played there before in their lives. And teams were just creating at will. It's just like, well, can like they get a save or can a D-man bail them out? And like maybe can they go down the ice and counterattack for a goal was pretty much the best that you could hope for once the puck crossed center.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of Domi and Marner, which we've seen very little of, and I think, to be honest, we're going to see very little of. Like, as much as we like to think, oh, this is a cool concept to play with, you have to imagine that Keefe is just going to put Marner back alongside Matthews when the time comes. But the idea of Domi and Marner is like, if Marner is going to be this guy that people talk about as like a Selke trophy candidate, like this level of defensive player, like he should be able to help a defensively inept, might be too strong a word, maybe it's not too strong a word, a less strong defensive center thrive in a way that, putting Nylander alongside Domi, as you said, creates this sort of disaster, and you kind of need one of them to be alongside Tavares probably. But it's this group now where you just have, you've got one checking line on the fourth line, which also sort of includes Ryan Reeves, which again hasn't been less of a problem lately, but could present a problem at some point. And then a third
I'm
line
okay
that.
with it though. I think you need that against Florida or Boston to some degree. I'm not saying all six or seven, but I like it would be also, I think, crazy to just not have Reeves in the lineup at all against those teams. I like I said, like I do believe that genuinely, like some level of like violence is required.
I'm open-minded to beginning the series with him there, but
Yeah.
I also am open-minded to the idea that there's a chance that it just kind of unravels itself or becomes
Yeah,
unplayable.
it's
And
entirely
so.
on the table. I also think like he has to provide it too. Like they played Boston twice last week. Was anyone left in pain because of anything Ryan Reeves did? No. And that's a problem. So, if he's in the lineup, like let's be clear of what that's for. Like, yes, some level of like cycling and offensive zone time that you could provide working the walls, but like by and large, it's gonna be like the puck goes into like Charlie McAvoy's corner. It goes into Hampus Lindholm's corner. It goes into Brandon Carlo's corner. And you provide some bumps and bruises that are going to wear them down over 2 weeks. And if you're not doing that, then there's really nothing for us to talk about here.
Yeah, like people aren't going to fight him necessarily
No.
because people don't want to fight Ryan Reeves. And in the playoffs, sometimes people just don't want to fight in general. But there's more than one way to affect other teams physically. And that is what he's employed to do. And, there's plenty of debate to be had over whether he's worth employing on those grounds. But if you're going to have him, that's what it's going to be. But if you're going to have him, like you're not going to get a lot of offense from a fourth line that includes him and Dewar, realistically. And it just the whole concept, and maybe this will just change when Marner comes back. I don't know. But the whole concept of having kind of two checking-ish lines that we can't count on to create any offense, like it feels like the thing that has made, to your point, the Leafs a little bit more refreshing this season is the idea that offensive juice is spread throughout the lineup. And so this move, and again, the Leafs aren't going to move very far in the standings. They're messing around with things. It's okay to try stuff. I think the difference here is that it was already tried. Like it was already tried and it failed. And that's why I find myself questioning this tinker more than I think I would most.
Yeah, I mean they've already moved Camp back to the 4C spot today. So I'm not gonna like overly like aggravate myself on it. I actually imagine a lot of it was inspired from the other way around where they wanted to try Dewar at center, and there's just no logical way to do that. Like, you're not moving Camp to the wing to
acclimate Dewar. No, he only plays center.
Yeah. So, and now we're seeing, now we're going to see Dewar on wing, which I'm interested in myself. So, I honestly think it was like partly like, you're new here, let's get your feet wet, let's put you in a position you're comfortable in. And like, we'll kind of try to move things around by and large, but like also respecting the guys that we want to keep in the lineup, like Ryan Reeves, and, you know, play it that way, Pontus Holmberg, so on and so forth. So I could see how he would arrive at that. I would be surprised if Camp is a 3C come playoffs, and I would question it to some degree. I do think it's funny because first year, I think we got some like playoff Camp, and then second year, I don't think we got playoff Camp. So you can make of that what you will. Maybe it was just a made up thing on the first one, but like he actually was good that first year against Tampa. He didn't really do much of anything in the second year in the playoffs, and he got absolutely steamrolled by Radko Gudas, and nobody did anything, which I thought was like pretty much summed up that series in one sequence of events right there. So like, I think he can contribute. I think you could, I could understand why they would move him up at times. I think it's tougher when you're, if you were like McMahon, Camp, Yarncroc third line, I could get there. I think with Nyes there, it makes it a little bit more difficult to get there logically. So it's just how they kind of shift things around. But it is, that's again why it's nice that this is being forced on them, because in previous years, I felt when Sheldon Keefe was experimenting, a lot of it was just entirely made up. You know, even when we would see him do it, it'd be like, well, you're not actually going to do that. Like, and you know it, and we all know it. But this year, it does seem like there's a little bit more of, like, if you earn it, we'll run it kind of thing. Like, there's enough capable guys here. If you earn it, we'll stick with it. And there's something to be said. Like, guys are getting chances and they're hungry for them.
I mean, McMahon's the perfect example of that. Like, he was pretty much stapled to fourth line only. And then next thing you know, he's third line, occasionally getting a second line look, getting PP2, you know, for better, for worse, getting the occasional penalty killing shift. Like, that is something guys respond to, the idea that they can earn more time. And speaking of time, we are a little bit low. So I think we're going to maybe talk goaltending, but we can leave goaltending for another day, see how that develops. We got to talk about defense with the addition of Edvinson. You know, kind of becoming, as we said when we discussed the trade, like the upgrade over Simon Benoit. And weirdly, as the forward lines have been relatively fluid with these injuries and experimentation, like the defense looks fairly locked in right now. Like it looks like they want to give Brody McCabe the chance to be that shutdown group. You know, they brought Labushkin in to play with Riley, maybe not in every situation, but largely, and they've stuck to that and it's been really good. And so what we're left with is this marriage between Edmondson and Liljegren, which on paper, you know, it's got the hallmarks of a pair that works. You know, it's the dependable old big veteran stay-at-home guy and the younger, more offensively imaginative guy. And you've got a left-right. Like, the ingredients are there for it to make sense. What has been your take on the first look at this group?
Well, first and foremost, because I feel like it's important to say, my heart does go out a little bit to Simon Benoit. Like, we've talked about him a lot. You know, I stop short of saying revelation. Like, I don't think they've stumbled across like a top three D-man or anything, but I think he's an NHL D-man and he's earned it. And I think he's, by and large, you know, he's played with his heart on his sleeve this year, and he's been a warrior for them. And I have all day for those kinds of players. Those kinds of human beings in general. Like, he came in and was very frank. He was like, I'm going to work my ass off and I'm going to steal a job from someone. And he did. Like, he got an opportunity and he ran with it. And just, you know, how can you not respect that from not just a hockey standpoint, but just from a life standpoint? And at the same time, like, we've talked about some struggles lately, and he's younger and he has no playoff experience. And in fact, he's never played an important game in the NHL basically in his life until this year. Like, not an important game for him, but I mean, like, an important game for a team that like actually is doing something. So that is a big adjustment, and I get it. And so I'm not, you know, I know that that's a tough decision, but yeah, like, You can already sort of start to see it with Joel Edmondson alongside Timothy Liljegren. It's just like he's an adult out there. That's what it looks like. It looks like he's a grown man adult.
He's
And
very much a grown man. There's no doubt about that.
And there was one sort of scrum off like an offside call, and it wasn't much. And it was like right at the blue line, and there were a couple of Philly guys in there. And Edmondson kind of just, he skated in. He didn't really like say anything. He just kind of, it was like a patrol officer. Like he just kind of like walked in and stared at everybody, and like everyone just kind of like disbanded. And it was just like, this is an adult, you know? Like he, like, not to say Benoit wouldn't get involved, because of course he would. Like we know that. But
To
like,
his own detriment, he would get
yeah,
involved.
sometimes. But like, but Edmondson, in terms of with the puck on his stick and just playing a very, very simple game of kind of knowing who he is and what he is and what he does, and which I think Benoit is very much still developing into that. You see the steadiness and the, you know, what I would hope to see is some like consistency of presence, and how he put, like, you know, that he's able to just string those kinds of games together with like some level of regularity that's important. And I think he'll also understand playoff hockey quite well. And so we'll see how that all kind of comes together. But if that pairing can kind of hold up, I think what happens, to your point too, is that Riley Labushkin pair actually has pretty good numbers so far. They've been very much on the right side of shot share, expected goals. They've outscored opponents 4-3, which isn't much at 5-on-5, but you know, it's better than the alternative. So you kind of start stringing those things together. And then what they do is often on offensive situations, they'll put out Riley with Liljegren, which I like. So there's a little bit of flexibility in there. And you know, the reality is the defense is not good. Like it's not a good defense. It's the best they can do with what they have.
Yeah, the ceiling is not particularly high, but you're starting to see the floor creep up. And Edmondson is a floor player. Like he, like you say, he's a guy who is sensible. He is going to make reads that you can trust. Yeah, I thought he played a strong game on Thursday against the Flyers. Like he's capable. He is also a player that, you know, it's just going to take a little bit of time to figure out exactly where within his range of outcomes he lies. Because like we talked about last episode, like he's someone who numbers are just going to be, it's going to be difficult to capture what he's doing statistically. And so he doesn't have a particularly wide range of outcomes. He's not going to be a superstar. He's not going to be an absolute bum. But over the next few weeks, we're going to find out like where is he living in that. And I don't know if that variance is enough to change the Maple Leafs' fate in a profound way. But it might be enough to change Liljegren's fate, which is kind of what matters here, where it's like Liljegren has been so inconsistent to the point that he's been completely impossible to trust in the playoffs at times. And there is a world where Edmondson's steady hand really helps straighten Liljegren out, which I think is the best case scenario for that trade and for the Maple Leafs, where they have a pair. You know, you know, their third pair, but all of their pairs are ones they can trust. Now, if anything, you could argue like the Brody McCabe one is the bigger question mark because we've seen that fail in the past, albeit with the guys on opposite sides, and that pair will be asked to do a lot more. And I'm not quite there yet with Edmondson where I'm like, okay, I'm totally sold and this pair is locked in and the two of them are going to be great. But there's an argument to be made that in I don't know, a week and a half, 2 weeks, however many games you want to say, like it's Riley and Labushkin and Edmondson Liljegren that you feel is pretty locked in, and it's Brody McCabe that are the ones that you wonder if they're able to rise to the challenge that is going to be ahead of them.
Yeah, so I kind of link it to, and I'm not, Timothy Liljegren's obviously not Drew Doughty, so I'm not obviously saying that. But when LA won their cups, and like when they were developing that team, like go look at who he was playing with. It was like, it was these steady grizzled vets. It was Rob Scuderi. It was Willie Mitchell. It was like these guys who a lot of teams would look at and say like past their prime. You know, Scuderi had already won a cup with Pitt. Like, you know, these guys are in their 30s, they're, you know, a little bit gritty and things of that nature. And this is like a extremely poor man's version of that in theory, in working theory, where it's like, yeah, like you're a talented young right-handed defenseman, and we're just gonna give you a stable left-handed veteran to essentially like, he's like a father like figure to you on the other side of the ice. Like, he's going to tell you where to go and he's going to tell you what to do. And it's like, you know, I remember the talk about when Charlie McAvoy was entering the league and he was playing with Zdeno Chara, and they were like, you know, like, McAvoy guy is like something. And everyone's like, yeah, because Zdeno Chara stands there and he's like, this is where you go. Like, he's like directing traffic and like the young kid is going around doing it all. But you have this like veteran who like understands the game and how it works at the pro level and what to do and how to conduct yourself. And like, that's what Edmonton is. Like, Benoit can't possibly provide that kind of thing to Liljegren because Benoit is still very much going through it himself. And if anything, Benoit was probably getting that from Jake McCabe, who's probably looking at him saying like, this is where you go, this is what you do, like so on and so forth. But now, you know, it's stretch drive time. Like, this is the most exciting time of year. Like, I don't know how you don't just like love it if you're a fan of the sport. And so it's like the veterans are together now, which it's not great. It's not like, I don't think anyone's looking at the Brody McCabe pairing going like, oh my God, like the Leafs are locking it down now.
Forget about scoring. When yeah. These guys like, are on the ice.
Yeah. Ilya Samsonov, like, untie your skates. Like, you're good. Like, take a seat in the crease. I don't think anyone's going along those lines, but in terms of like veteran ability to, you know, log big minutes and be established within them and hopefully not be like a crazy level of liability, that's realistically the best option they have. And it's like, it's a defense by committee. I think it has to be fluid. I don't think the forwards have to be by committee, but I hope that they're employed by committee. Like, we talk about like spreading it out, and I'll always just go back to like, of course you're gonna pair Matthews and Marner together. Like, it would be asinine to not, but like, you can start games where they're not paired together. Like, Chicago used to do that all the time with Taves and Kane. Like, they would not start on the same line. And then they would put them together in critical times and be like, let's lock and load and go. And I think that's really how they should approach it. I think we're like, you got to like go back and steal things from teams, right? It's like, look how they brought these guys along. Look how they deployed their lineup. Like, go, like, there's tons of historical evidence that you can find for how successful teams deployed and ran things. Like, we talk about the Pittsburgh Penguins and like, not just their defensive by committee, but like that first year they won when like Sid got hurt and they realized like, hey, like there's like actually other good hockey players on this team. Like, maybe we should value them and like have them part of the battle. Like, they're like all things that you can, like, they're there. Like, you just got to do them. Like, I don't know how else to say it.
All right. I think that's a good place to leave it for today. We appreciate everybody who listened in. And we encourage you to leave ratings and reviews and tell everybody whether they want to hear it or not about the podcast. And we can continue to grow through the Maple Leafs playoff push, however long that lasts. So we will be with you again next week.
Everyone is looking at me. Time is running and we're down by three. Look inside yourself, what do you see? The pain is in your mind, no, nothing stops me. Everyone is looking at me. Heart is pounding and we're down by three. Look inside yourself, I know what I see.